This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
The Humanist Network News.
It's June 24th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang, calling in from the headquarters of the American Humanist Association down in Washington, D.C.
And of course, I'm podcasting from the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition podcast studio here in Albany, New York. So, Jenda, welcome. It's nice to have you here on the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, I understand that you've had quite the busy month. You've been traveling to all corners of the United States. Where were you recently?
I was in Tempe, Arizona, at the AHA's 68th annual conference out there, and it was 3 days of a lot of good speakers, meeting a lot of interesting humanists from all around the country, and we had about 300 people attend.
Nice.
And a bunch of breakout speakers, and was able to meet a lot of interesting, fun people.
And I understand that the weather was hot.
Yeah, but as opposed to the East Coast, it's a dry heat. But it was pretty bad out there. So
what were some highlights of the conference for you?
There were a lot of things. I mean, P.Z. Myers was the Humanist of the Year, and he gave a really interesting talk, kind of about his experiences and stuff, because he's gotten a lot of media attention recently, and it was nice too because he was also around for the entire conference, so people had the opportunity to kind of come up and just, speak with him on a more casual basis.
Well, that's cool.
The Reverend Barry Lynn, the executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, was there. Barbara Forrest, Donald Johansson gave a keynote address. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who we'll be hearing from in a little bit, was there. And, they were at the conference, and not all of them, but some of them were able to kind of stay through the whole thing. And I think it's especially nice when you have like an award winner who's there who can kind of also hang out, and so people can have a more casual chance to interact. And I mean, we had a bunch of breakout sessions, so we had a lot of different kind of people talking about all sorts of different topics, which was very, very interesting as well.
Nice. So you mentioned Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. What was he doing there?
He was actually the 2009 Isaac Asimov Science Award winner. So he's the, for people who may not know a lot about him, he is the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History out in New York City. He served on, a lot of commissions and panels. I think back in 2001, then President Bush appointed him to serve on a commission that studied, the future of like NASA and the space industry, aerospace industry as a whole. In 2006, the director of NASA appointed him to serve on their really prestigious advisory council. And, he's also a very prolific author and, has written a lot of articles. His most recent book is called Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries. And it's pretty interesting. And he is one of the reasons we gave him the award this year was that He's a popularizer of science, which I think is definitely in present-day America something very important and very needed.
Absolutely, and you forgot on your list of credentials there that he's a hater of the animated Disney dog Pluto, right?
That's a good point. He bucked the trend a few years ago and was one of the first people to say that that Pluto should not be considered a planet, which I know he. As he says in his speech, I think he got a lot of hate mail from kids,
right?
Actually, kind of complaining about his position on that. But after a while, I believe whatever commission it was kind of vindicated him and agreed that Pluto should no longer considered a planet. So he was definitely a visionary in that sense.
Right. Well, enough talking about him. Let's hear his thank you remarks from the conference. The segment's going to start with Jennifer Kalmanson giving us more of an introduction for Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And Jennifer herself is a systems engineer at the Goddard Space Center. She received her MS in space science from Florida Tech, and she's worked on Hubble service missions, and she's currently working on some land satellite objectives. And to top it off, she is, of course, a humanist celebrant. So very fitting for this introduction to Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Good afternoon. I have this afternoon the great privilege of introducing to you a very learned man who has used his access to the ivory tower not to lay upon it one more brick to increase its height, but to install an elevator so that we may all enjoy the view. For any structure to achieve meaningful height, it must rest upon a broad base of support. Our collective human progress inches higher only as its base of support, the minds of the public, are brought into full appreciation of the highest pinnacles of human understanding. In 1998, the American Humanist Association established the Isaac Asimov Science Award to recognize a person whose work has contributed significantly to the public understanding and appreciation of science. This award is presented only occasionally for particularly outstanding work. Upon achieving his PhD in astrophysics in 1991 from Columbia University in New York, and after doing the obligatory stint as a postdoctoral researcher at no less an institution, mind you, than Princeton University, I might add, Dr. deGrasse Tyson immediately brought his career into the public sphere by taking a job at the American Museum of Natural History's Hayden Planetarium in New York City. He's moved up the ladder at Hayden Planetarium and has served as its director since 1996. During his tenure there, greatly broadening the outreach and scientific scope of the planetarium's activities in bringing an appreciation for the cosmos to the public. For those of you who have been following the news over the last few years of how the astronomy community is changing the way it looks at Pluto, you may be surprised to know that Dr. deGrasse Tyson had already modified his solar system exhibit, the solar system planets display at the Hayden Planetarium, to include only 8 planets and excluding the solar system body Pluto in 2000. This was a full 6 years before Dr. Mike Brown convinced the International Astronomical Union that Pluto is in fact only a dwarf planet, likely a stray Kuiper belt object that became trapped by our sun's gravity. Now, my own personal opinion, I think Pluto just joined a better club, but that's just my opinion. As anyone with a television set knows, however, Dr. deGrasse Tyson did not limit his promotion of science to those individuals he could reach through the planetarium. In 2004, Dr. deGrasse Tyson hosted a special NOVA miniseries titled Origins, which covered the subject of cosmic evolution. Now, as the host of the public broadcasting service's show NOVA Science Now, Dr. deGrasse Tyson has leveraged PBS's wide audiences to bring intelligent discussions of cutting-edge scientific and technological advances into millions of homes, millions of minds. NOVA Science Now is only one of the many public appearances by which Dr. deGrasse Tyson continues his mission of enlightening the masses through appreciation of the cosmos. He's also a regular on the History Channel's show The Universe, and has authored numerous articles and publications ranging in technical scope from the Astronomical Journal to the magazines Natural History and Parade. He's even made an occasional appearance on Jeopardy. If there's an audience to reach, Dr. deGrasse Tyson will reach it. He also shapes the future. He does not merely communicate what we already know about the universe. He has also served to shape our national policy on how future resources should be spent in ongoing discovery. In 2001, he was appointed by the president to serve on the Commission on the Future of the United States Aerospace Industry, which studied how best to keep the U.S. aerospace industry competitive and effective in a changing global environment. As a contractor in that aerospace industry, I'm very grateful for that work. The commission met 6 times and produced 4 reports that would shape U.S. space policy for the next decade. In 2004, he was again appointed by the president to serve, this time on the President's Commission on Implementation of United States Space Exploration Policy, for which he received the NASA Distinguished Public Service Medal, which is the highest civilian honor bestowed by NASA. And this commission commonly publicized as the Moon, Mars, and Beyond Initiative, studied in great detail how exactly the United States could establish ongoing exploration programs to return humans to the Moon and then onward to Mars. This was a huge effort. I mean, everybody in the industry was involved in this, and without good stewardship and leadership, it would have gone absolutely nowhere. As part of its research, the Commission sponsored studies by the aerospace industry organizations to describe the technical details of how they would build, execute, and fund such missions within the Commission's allowable timeframe. As a direct result of the Moon, Mars, and Beyond activities, NASA began laying the groundwork for what is expected to be the next Apollo-scale U.S. exploration program, Constellation. Dr. deGrasse Tyson's policy contributions will continue to resonate in decades from now as the full exploration program unfolds. So, I now present to you the man who helps us all see the cosmos from the topmost reaches of our scientific progress, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the 2009 AHA Isaac Asimov Science Award recipient.
Thanks for that warm and extensive introduction. There's no way I can live up to that. Now it's just to be disappointed, you know. When I was invited to come to this conference, I was told I would get this award. And so I was invited to then give a talk. I said, I can't give a talk. I can't. I give too many talks. And I don't know that I can give a talk that isn't already like on YouTube right now, all right? So what we agreed, we'd have like a slightly different plan, if with your permission. And that plan would be that I would give my acceptance remarks intended to stimulate some depth of curiosity within you about the world. And then we have a conversation over the rest of the time of the session about some of those subjects or any other subject that stimulates you or disturbs you, for which I may have insight to share. Okay, so that's how we do this. We okay with that? We're good. Okay, all right. By the way, I checked my orbital calculations before I arrived, and I realized that on June 5th, today, that Earth swings about a quarter mile from the surface of the sun with Tempe, Arizona, right there, closest to it. It's an elliptical orbit, and it just swings Tempe right there, coming on out. It was like 65 degrees in New York. I said, I wonder what it is in Tempe, Arizona. 100 degrees, there it was. I didn't know the thing went three digits. I didn't know it had three digits in it. I was like shaking it, you know. So I get this award, and I realize, perhaps purposefully, my award, in fact, the Isaac Asimov Award, does not have the word humanist in it. All the other awards have humanist. I wrote them down. We got here the Humanist Pioneer Award and the Humanist Heroine Award. Heroine as in female hero. Right, okay, just in case, I don't know if I pronounced it right. Just... the female version of the word hero. Humanist of the Year Award. So mine doesn't have the word humanist in it. And I'm actually quite cool with that because I never really wanted to be an ist. Or an ism, for that matter. Actually, I am an ist. I'm a scientist. But that's the only ist I'm taking. All right? All the other ists I'm not going to take because here's what worries me. Maybe it doesn't worry you, and that's cool. I don't have a problem with that. But what worries me is the moment you are announced as an ist or an ism, the moment that happens in a conversation, the person with whom you are conversing establishes an entire philosophical worldview on you. They hand it to you before any words are exchanged. So now, if they oppose that ism, you are already in a hole in the conversation that you want to conduct. You got to dig out of that hole before they even want to listen to what you have to say. Because, in fact, they believe they already know everything you have to say. Because you're an ism. And so, and what the remarkable thing, of course, is that the ists and the isms associated with humanism, it practically couldn't be more diverse among the isms that are out there. That's just kind of interesting, actually. That you would have theologians who are part of this movement, that's kind of interesting. That's kind of interesting. You don't have atheists who are part of the fundamentalist religious movement. It just doesn't work. It doesn't happen that way. It just doesn't. So I didn't want to be an ism. And here's what's curious. So people don't know what I am. I just come into a conversation and we just start fresh. Fresh. So what are you thinking? I'm thinking about this. Oh, why? For this reason. Oh, I didn't know that. It's got this pure beginning. Seeds get planted. Plants germinate and grow. And so here's what's curious. You know, so, in the car right over here, someone said, why are you visiting him? I said, yeah. I said, why? Oh, I'm here for the American Humanist Association conference. And he said, oh, you mean those godless heathens? And I said, okay. Yeah, I guess they're in there somewhere, I guess. There might be some who are not, but it would certainly enclose those who are, right? That's for sure. So here's what's interesting, I think. Out of all the stuff I've written in my life, two essays at all address God or spirituality. Everything else is just simply about the universe. But those two essays get remembered. And they're actually rather critical in a very sort of defensible way. One of them is Get Religion Out of the Science Classroom. But I don't have the energy or the time or the interest to get religion out of anything else. I just don't, all right? We got other people who are worried about that. We got Margaret Downey who's getting religion off the dollar bills. She owed me $2 and gave it, like, God has crossed off every dollar she's given me. So it's in we trust. I'm thinking, might as well write something in there if you're going to cross it off. You know, in Pluto we trust. Something, put something in there. If you're going to deface the money, you might as well make it interesting. So I don't have that energy. I can't. So there's religion and government and there's other places. I'll take my one little thing, get it out of the science classroom, otherwise we undermine the science enterprise and its foundations where the kids are learning. So watch. This then got associated with the atheist movement. So I'm there and I stumble on my wiki page. Somebody put together my wiki page. Right? I didn't have nothing to do with it. And what's spooky, this is spooky, is that my wiki page is more up to date than my homepage. That's just scary, okay? I just finished on Jon Stewart, did the Jon Stewart thing. That's like on a Tuesday. By Thursday, I think, let me put this on my webpage. I go on wiki page, it's there with a link. It's there. Somebody's paying attention. That's kind of spooky. Days of anonymity are long gone. So anyway, I'm looking at the page, my wiki page, and it says, Neil deGrasse Tyson, a longtime atheist. And I said, I never said that. Where did that come from? So I thought, well, what am I? Because I said I'm not an ist and I'm not an ism. So what should I put there? I said, like, so you can edit it, right? That's the whole thing about wiki. By the way, I had in my office 3 days ago the inventor of Wikipedia. And I had a few things to. But In Q&A, if you want to know about my conversation with him, I'll be happy to tell you. But I actually, I tore a new one, but that's too crass here. I gave him some suggestions on how to improve the Wikipedia. So I took it out and I put in agnostic. Because I think, based on all the folks who are agnostic historically, I come closest to the behavior of an agnostic than the behavior of an atheist. So I put it in. 3 days later, it was back to atheist. 3 days later. Then I learned that there are people who want to equate agnosticism with atheism. They want to say it's the same thing. They're saying that, like, those who say they're agnostic, they're just like chicken. They're just afraid to say, and okay, fine. So I went back in, and I said, all right, I got to be cleverer about this. So I changed it to widely claimed by atheists, he is an agnostic. Okay? So now you can't touch that, right? What are you going to do with that? We're done. It still says that today. That was like a year ago. So here was an interesting, and so like I said, I don't have the energy to sort of extract God out of culture. I just don't. I'll just keep it out of my science classroom. That's all I am. All right, so this just happened a few days ago. My Facebook page. Okay? Now, I edit my own Facebook page here, but people can contribute to me. By the way, the fastest growing demographic of Facebook people are people 50 and over. Right? Just so you know. It used to be you have to be like 12 and under or something, now it's like 50 and over. So I put in a note about what I was doing at the time, as you're supposed to do. Let everybody know all your business. Was it just 5 years ago you didn't tell anybody anything about your life? Now everybody knows everything about your life? When did that happen? Did I miss that memo? Where was that before I interrupted myself? So I put a Facebook entry. I was in Florida watching the shuttle launch to service the Hubble telescope. And beautiful launch, beautiful weather, beautiful fix-it mission. Everybody came back safe. So I said, I'm in Florida, Cape Canaveral. I said, perfect launch. They only give you like 20 words to communicate in this little bit, so it has to be very efficient. Almost, at some level, it's like a haiku, you know? It's just launch, beautiful. Emotions. Rested. You know, you have to like, you gotta cut away all the extraneous work. You know that if you tried it, you know, you gotta keep it. So I said, all right, let me test the waters. And I said, Godspeed, shuttle astronauts. That's what I said. Now, let's put some context in this. 1962, John Glenn goes into orbit, comes back. Banner headlines on the New York Daily News. Godspeed, John Glenn. That phrase is cultural within the aerospace community. You say that like you're saying hello to someone. Someone's going into orbit, into space. Godspeed, the astronaut. It's just... You even say it for test pilots. You're doing something at the edge of our technology. Godspeed. So I put it in, and then people get to comment on that thread. Within, like, minutes. Listen, I'm thinking, don't these people have something else to do? In 120 seconds after I put this, aren't they eating dinner or something? What's... So, one person said, Godspeed, I thought he was an atheist. Then I had the agnostic defense. No, he's clearly an agnostic. It says it over here on the Facebook page. Because the Facebook page, you list all of your private information, like your sexual preference, your religion. You know what my favorite religion put up there? You can look at other people's Facebook pages. One of them is Pastafarian. Gotta love the Pastafarians. Are they spaghetti monster folks? Yeah? Good. So it's there. And so I had to jump back in. And I said, if you're religious, this word means something religious. This phrase, this term means something religious to you. If you're not, it simply means successful mission, come back safe. So I will not deny myself access to vocabulary because some people see it as religious. Then I'm saying in my thread, I said, surely there are atheists in the world who have used the word goodbye. Goodbye means God be with you. Who here did not know that? Shame on you! And I bet you've used the word, haven't you? Fine. Guilty as charged. Goodbye came down through the generations, starting out as God be with you, because you're about to go off on a trip. Back then, they were not in spacecraft, right? So it's kind of like Godspeed, but you were just walking, right? So God be with you, because you were leaving the city gates. You needed some protection. God be with you. And now it's just goodbye. And you're not thinking, oh my gosh, I said something religious. I mean, even Margaret says goodbye sometimes, right? Or maybe you say, bye-bye. You say good, bye-bye. But the flight attendant said bye-bye, right? They took out the God part of that. So I'm intrigued by this.
Tyson, you're listening to Humanist Network News.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jenda Huang, and you're listening to the thank you comments of Neil deGrasse Tyson at the 68th Annual Conference of the American Humanist Association in Tempe, Arizona. I didn't do you blame all the constellations, 'cause you can
take ass when it falls on you. I'm honored when those among us who see my work and analogize me to Carl Sagan, who we all admire and love, and how he could put science literacy on the map and make it sort of a national dialogue about what you know and don't know in the universe. And he did it with passion and compassion. There's a difference, though, between Carl Sagan and me. That difference is, and I'm embarrassed to say this, I don't have the energy to debate people whose brains are just completely tangled messes of irrational thought. So you have never seen me debating a UFO person, a religious fundamentalist, a crop circle person. You've not seen, have you? Have you? It's not. In fact, a year ago, I spoke at the amazing meeting in Las Vegas. Some of you, I think, were there. TAM 6, the meeting put on by Amazing Randy. And I was honored to have been invited. And that was my first time ever speaking to a skeptics community. Doesn't mean I don't have thoughts about it. I'm like practically a charter subscriber to the Skeptical Inquirer. And I've even contributed to it. I'm there. I'm reading it. I can talk it up like the next person. But my energy to enlightenment is principally directed at trying to get people to think straight in the first place, rather than to undo the tangled mental pathways later on. So here's my pact with you. I will do my damnedest to get them thinking straight up front. But if I fail, I'm handing them over to you. You take them from there. All right? I just let you know that. Okay? And I'll conclude before we just go to our conversation. I realize that there are like books here that I wrote. I didn't like plan for that. It's not, I mean, they're here and that's great. But it's not like I said, oh, you know, sell my books. I didn't like, I had nothing to do with that. They went and got it all by themselves. But part of thinking straight in the first place is sort of not only trying to get adults with open minds to think straight, but of course kids. And I have two kids, one aged 8, one aged 12. Thank you. Sir, is this talk on my wiki page yet? Eight and 12. Well, I have a lot on my plate right now, but one of the things that's on my back burner that I'm doing sort of in my head rather than on paper is I'm writing a book called How to Raise a Scientifically Literate Child. Okay? It's not yet. It's still a couple of years. Don't be calling me in a month to say, is it out yet? Because it's still happening in my head. I'm still gathering data. And the data comes from experiments I do on my two kids. So I got them right here. Where is it? Either watching TV or do an experiment on them. This is the choice. So... No, it's not like I tie electrodes to their head. No, so what it's about is, it's not about what science experiments to do. It's not about teaching them how things work. Those are aspects of science literacy, but that's not the core. The core of science literacy is, through what lens do you see the world? How does the world come to you as you look upon it? And that is not trained by buying a chemistry kit or by learning how your microwave oven works. That comes about by the stimulation of curiosity. It comes about by not valuing the answer as much as you value the pathways that may or may not lead to the answer. It's the pathways of exploration that enable you to probe the world around you. And so this book is about how to immerse the growing child in environments that stimulate that curiosity. And let me give you a couple of examples that I can report on thus far. These are intermediate results. By the way, this is a very, very hard experiment to do because you can't, there's no control sample. I don't have another pair of kids and leave them in a box. That are like identical twins, you just can't do that. So a lot of the book will really be strongly circumstantial. Okay? Because you can't do the actual experiment with the control sample. So I'll give you an example. So my son, no, sorry, this happened to my daughter. So my daughter is 7, tooth comes out. I'm told that if you put it under your pillow, Tooth Fairy will come and swap it out for cash. She said, really? And I said, I'm told. No, I'm not lying, right? I'm told. So she puts it under her pillow. So sneaky. Now, I realize, maybe you only know this when you have kids, why it is that the Tooth Fairy works, you know, I mean, why that whole story works, because they lose their teeth over the years where they're most gullible to that kind of story. Then they stop losing their teeth, and then there's no hope that they would ever believe such a story, but they're not losing their teeth anymore. So it's just this few years where they actually just believe it. All right, so, puts it under the pillow. She wakes up, there's money under the pillow. She said, Daddy, Daddy, Mommy, Tooth Fairy came. So I said, really? I said, how do you know? I said, well, There's money under the pillow. I said, how do you know it's a tooth fairy? He said, well, because you told me that it might be a tooth fairy. I said, okay, fine. So more tooth, more teeth. This happens with more teeth. More money. And then I said, have you ever thought of testing whether, in fact, it's a tooth fairy? Do you want to, like, set up a camera or you know? And so I just started to put into her some level of doubt. Or not doubt, because doubt is that's, yeah, just pathways of inquiry to test the idea. Okay? Because doubt is just, I doubt it, and then you go back and have a beer. You want to be able to doubt and do something about your doubt. So here's what happened. She began to think that maybe it's the parents who are swapping the teeth out with money. So she arranged at her school to do the test. And how do you do it at school? You get someone whose tooth comes out while they're at school. And then they don't tell their parents that the tooth came out, and then put it under the pillow without the parents knowing. Parents are dumb, stupid there. They're not good. They can't pull that one off. And so that was a way to test for it. How did that came out? So they did the experiment. And one of the kids, so she prompted one of her friends to do that, and they did it, and the tooth was not removed. And they all agreed that it must be the parents who were doing it.
So yeah. Now
you didn't
tell the tooth fairy to come.
So now what? So now in the same case, my daughter, she was 5, she comes up with an idea, a hypothesis, that all fairies are female. I said, Miranda, what are you saying? How do you even get, what? There's got to be some, like, guy fairies out there. She said, no, they're all female. And I said, well, how do you know? And she said, they all wear skirts. I said, holy. Tinkerbell, just go down the list. All the fairies have skirts. And so it's this kind of inquiry that, and it's got nothing to do with, like I said, your microwave oven. It just simply has to do with information and how you view the information that's coming to you. And it's not a matter of squashing fun storytelling. That's not what this is about. This is about just investigating what comes in front of you. And I'll give you just 2 more examples and we'll just go to conversation. In another example, my daughter, when she was the right age to be a huge Hannah Montana fan. By the way, there are more members of the Hannah Montana fan club than there are total number of people in the United States who have any professional association with the aerospace industry. Now, I say this because when you look at the strength of lobbying groups, you just keep that in mind, that's all. So I said, Miranda, I saw like a poster of Hannah Montana today. It was like huge, it was as big as a wall. You know what her next sentence to me was? She said, how big was the wall? Not all walls are the same size. It's that level of inquiry that I'm talking about. And like I said, I don't have her twin living in a box to test whether that twin would have made that same statement. But I can tell you that it's those kinds of statements that when she comes out of this scientifically literate, I don't care what she does in life, she's got what she needs to not be taken advantage of by others, as we know is so often the case, or to not become so captured in your ignorance that you then want to convert others to it. So thank you for this award, and thank you for your warm reception upon my getting that award. I just want to have a conversation with you now about life, the universe, and everything. So thank you. Yeah.
Prove to me.
literature rack, what might your responses be?
You mean to the fact that the Noah's flood may be Grand Canyon? Yeah, I mean... You know, like I said, I've got to get him young, you know, when getting thinking straight in the first place. I have two replies, neither of which may fully satisfy me. Where I work in New York, at the Rose Center for Earth and Space, there's a huge exhibit on the Big Bang. Occasionally, someone walks up and said, "You make no mention of God in there. Why not?" And I said, "Why don't you go to the exhibit on human origins first, and then come back to us?" And then they never make it back. Because we have monkeys holding hands with people, you know, the skeletons. So it's clear that biological issues, evolution and the like, is of much greater significance to the religious community and as an affront to their belief system than even the Big Bang is. Because they just never make it back. We lead a tranquil time over there in the Big Bang because we have monkeys holding hands with people in our human evolution exhibit hall. So what I would do is, I would take a detour from the Grand Canyon and visit Meteor Crater. Because the Grand Canyon, however long you think it took to make the Grand Canyon, it took a tenth of a second to make Meteor Crater. A tenth or less. An asteroid the size of the sphere that contains our planetarium itself slammed into Earth going 10 miles per second, left a hole in the ground 60 stories deep, practically a mile across, tenth of a second. It fell from the sky. So you want to be impressed. When I was a kid, 14 years old, and made my first trip to both of those, you know, I looked at Grand Canyon, that's kind of nice. Okay. Went to Meteor Crater, I couldn't speak. Just realizing how quickly that hole got made and how susceptible we are as little squishy human beings walking around on the surface. So people will say what they want, they'll believe what they want. I would just simply say keep it out of the science classroom. And that's all. We live in a pluralistic society, politically, religiously. So there are people, all you'll know is that they will not contribute to our scientific frontier. But so will a whole lot of other people not contribute to our scientific frontier. They just simply won't do it as religious fundamentalists, as opposed to whatever else might be the intellectual handicap that we carry. So I can't argue with them. I'd rather, like I said, teach them how the world works in the first place. So that may be a fully unsatisfying answer to you. But otherwise, there's a flood, and there's this, and there's a fossil, and then it goes on and on and on. Meanwhile, you could have enlightened 20 people on how to think like a scientist. So that's really what I do. And in fact, in the book Death by Black Hole, in spite of that title, it's really about how science works. And it's the full expression of everything I know about how the frontier of science moves forward. And occasions that interfere with that and occasions that propel it. And it's a very candid assessment of that. And I'd recommend it for you if you need some ways to think about science and its relationship to our understanding of the cosmos. And if anyone here has read Death by Black Hole, would you agree with that? Because I wrote it, so maybe I'm biased, but that's my intent, and I think it succeeds at that.
Now, I believe it's been proven that the universe is expanding.
The proof is that we shouldn't use the word proof ever with science. Because
evidence, yeah.
Yeah, there's compelling evidence. The only evidence we have ever had on what the universe is doing has told us that we're expanding.
Now, and a theory for that is dark matter.
Well, no, we were expanding long before even dark matter was discovered. We didn't need dark matter to expand.
Okay.
We're expanding, that's well, it. Wait, so now, what we discovered in 1998 was this mysterious pressure in the vacuum of the cosmos that is operating against the natural efforts of gravity. and taking our expansion and accelerating it. So we're not only expanding, we're accelerating in our expansion. We blame that on dark energy. Dark energy, we have no clue what it is, but we measure its existence, and that's why we speak of it as a real thing. We call it dark energy, but we could have just called it Fred. You know, I mean, it's just, okay? Same with dark matter. 85% of all the gravity we measure in the universe is traceable to a substance about which we know nothing. We call that Wilma, right? So, Fred and Wilma, one day we'll know what it is, but right now, we measure its existence, and those are the placeholder terms we give it.
But my question is...
Okay. All right.
Is there any possibility that the Big Bang wasn't just one single moment, that it's a continuous process, and that's what's pushing the universe apart?
Well, the signature of the Big Bang is quite singular. I mean, we know what a Big Bang looks like, and it's very hot, and matter and energy form a soup, a condition wholly unfamiliar with anything we would see in everyday life. And we don't see that happening continuously. We see that only happening 14 billion years ago. As we look out in space, we see things not as they are, but as they once were, given the time it's taken light to reach us. So I don't see you as you are. I see you as you were 12 nanoseconds ago, 12 billionths of a second ago, the time it takes light to reach me. So I put you out halfway across the universe, you're not even born yet. To me, you're not even born. You're like...
This is a new aging, I think. This is about some pop culture, science and pop culture, Star Trek. I don't want to ruin the movie for anybody if they haven't seen it. There's a man on a planet, and he looks up in the sky and sees another planet. It's, you know, moon size or so, to give a relative idea about how far it is away. And it is collapsed into a black hole. Now, I would think that, you know, this just the physics of it, that that might be very dangerous for somebody on a planet that's within sight of another planet.
It's definitely dangerous for people on that planet itself. Let's establish that fact up front. There's a device in this movie where they can turn a planet into a black hole. Black holes have very high surface gravity, but their total gravity is unchanged. So if the sun were to become a black hole right this instant, it would finally cool off. If the sun were to become a black hole, we would still orbit the sun in a year, and nothing would change for the rest of us. Its mass didn't increase, and in Newton's laws of gravity, all that's in there is how far away are you from the center of that object, and what the mass is of you and that object. That's it. And if you just turn it into a black hole, it's the same mass. It's just really, really small. And so it's really high gravity near the surface, but that's not where we're going. So it'd be a spectacular sight, bad for the residents of the black hole itself.
I'm a contributor to the Planetary Society, but I have a disagreement, a policy disagreement with them. I think that we should limit Mars missions to robotic equipment and not send human beings. It takes too long, it's too dangerous, and we should be content with whatever information we get through unmanned probes. The question is, do you agree or disagree?
Oh, okay. You received some applause there, by the way. So you have some supporters. I'm in my advancing years. I've become rather pragmatic. I've come to recognize some fundamental truths about human behavior. Wish it were different, but it's not. It's how it is. And how it is that nobody names schools after robots. Nobody has ticker tape parades for robots. It just doesn't happen. There were robots in the 1960s. There was a rover on the moon. You didn't know about it, did you? Because astronauts were on their way to the moon. There's a lot of talk that we pay great attention to our robots today in space, and no one pays attention to the astronauts. That's because the astronauts are not advancing a space frontier. The moment one of us advances a space frontier, everybody talks about it, because they're risking their life We are not risking their life. They're risking their life. And the history of our culture as humans, for whatever reason, values the efforts of those who risk their lives to discover. Statues are built to them. They get remembered forever. And so there's an aspect of space exploration that goes beyond scientific discovery and captures the essence of exploration that has driven human beings in the history of our culture beyond the limits previously set by others. And that enterprise is what the nation buys into. That enterprise is what stimulates the interest and the urge to move a frontier out. And so I can tell you, as an astrophysicist, that my colleagues sincerely believe that NASA is their private science funding agency. And when NASA decides to spend money on a manned program, they'll cry foul. Pause. When was NASA founded? It was in response to Sputnik in a geopolitical era where we felt we were losing a war. That's why NASA was founded. Okay, well, not only that, how much science money has NASA ever spent in any given year? Average over the past 50 years, it's been about 23% of the total budget for NASA has gone to science. The rest has gone to the space station, the shuttle, all the manned programs. So, in fact, scientific discovery is the tail on a much larger dog. In fact, the history of scientific discovery on its grandest scales is just that. Darwin didn't say, I need a boat to go to the Galapagos, let me hire one. No, the boat had other agendas and he piggybacked along. Somebody else wrote that check. Captain Cook goes to the South Pacific. Why is he going? You read it. Well, he wants to measure the transit of Venus across the surface of the sun. Only happens every few hundred years. If you measure that accurately, you get the scale of measurement in the solar system. We did not know the distance from the Earth to the sun until that expedition. So, there it is. A set of British ships going to the South Pacific, the Polynesian Pacific, because that's the only place you could see the transit of Venus, where Venus moves across the sun. Well, wait a minute. Who wrote that check? England wrote that check. Did they really care about how far Earth was from the sun? You think so? That's kind of odd, isn't it? What happens a few years after Captain Cook comes back? What happens a few... Yeah, I've got to calm down here. What happens a few years after he comes back? England takes control of the South Pacific. England takes control of Australia. England rules that entire quadrant of the world. That's who wrote that check. So let's be honest with ourselves about what enables science. It's never been science. It's been politics. It's been war. It's been economics. And I've come to recognize that fact. And so I could say, let's just do the science with the robots. We'll lose the budget because the budget is driven by the manned program budget. And the science is piggybacking that. That is my response to you.
That was Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson fielding some questions from participants of the 68th annual conference hosted by the American Humanist Association held in Tempe, Arizona. You can learn more about Dr. Tyson by visiting his website, haydenplanetarium.org/Tyson. You can also learn more about and purchase his books, such as Death by Black Hole and, of course, The Pluto Files.
And tune in next month to hear an interview with Dr. Tyson. Jennifer Bardi, the editor of the Humanist magazine, and I sit down and have an opportunity to talk with Dr. Tyson, ask him some more ask him some more questions and get his point of view on some other issues in addition to what you've already heard in his acceptance speech.
I'm excited for that, Jinda. So that about wraps up our show for this month, right, Jinda?
Yeah, it does. And listeners, you can send us your thoughts, suggestions, or comments to hnn@americanhumanist.org. And as a reminder, for the other 3 weeks of the month, Humanist Network News comes out as an e-zine, so don't forget to read it, and you can go online to check that out at americanhumanist.org/HNN.
And for those of you who might be new joining us here with the HNN podcast, you can check out all of our back episodes, and you can also read transcripts and just learn a little bit more about all of our previous shows at americanhumanist.org/HNN/podcast. And I mentioned last month that we were hoping to have a new RSS feed, and we are still in the process of obtaining said RSS feed. So stay tuned on this one and more news to come. So Jinda, it's a little lonely here in Albany. I got to tell you, I mean, I'm in this little dark room with a black foam, and it's quite hot, and I'd like some company.
Yeah, that is my apologies for that, as I'm sure the readers could tell, or as the listeners could tell, and it's not just my voice, but I am calling in via the phone this month, so unfortunately I wasn't able to make it up to Albany, but definitely, you know, start of July, I'm gonna book a plane ticket, and for sure next month I will join you in that cold dark, in that warm dark.
You mean to tell me that this isn't your natural sexy radio voice that we're hearing right now?
Oh, no, unfortunately not. It's slightly distorted, and I wasn't sure if everyone would get that.
So there you go, listeners. Stay tuned next month, hear Jinda live and in person, and also listen to our interview with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Jinda Huang.
Thanks, folks.